don't think so. The Economic Development Budget Division for Friday, March 16th, 2007 will come to order. We're going to start out with some quick department overviews. Let's hear from the Board of Mediation Services. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, and good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am James Cunningham, the Commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services. I do believe you should all have a packet of information from my agency. It's a dark blue folder. Mr. Chair, if it would be okay with you, I would just like to provide the briefest of overviews of the agency and highlight a couple of the change items in our budget.
That's
and then
exactly what we want.
Spend the rest of the time for whatever questions the committee may have. Again, I'm the commissioner of the BMS. The Bureau of Mediation Services is the smallest cabinet-level agency. We were established in 1939. Our sole mission is to promote the stable and constructive labor management relations throughout the state. We do that with three primary programs. The first is our mediation program. In that capacity, we provide services to both organized labor groups and public sector management groups to help them resolve their collective bargaining disputes. We do that in two primary ways. That is coming in and helping them when they are at an impasse in their own kind of at the table collective bargaining efforts. We will send a mediator out there and try to assist them to find ways that they can kind of get through their dispute and find come up with an agreement that they can both sides can live with. We also assist those same groups in grievance mediations where they may have a grievance by a single employee or a group of employees. With regard to just kind of the numbers, just briefly, over the past 4 years, we've received over 2,500 individual petitions for mediations, and these come from all over the state, every county, school district, other municipality. We've received over 2,500 of them. In conjunction with those, we've done almost 4,000 meetings over the last couple of years, and despite that high volume, we've been fortunate enough that we've only had 8 public sector strikes in the last 4 years. And I will point out for the committee's record that 3 of those 8 happened before I came on board. So I think, you know, it shows we really do have a very good impact on the state's economy and the atmosphere between organized labor and management all over the state. The second area that the agency works in is in our representation area. That is one that is more of a quasi-judicial function. That deals primarily with the makeup and composition of organized bargaining groups. The third area is our labor management cooperative efforts. Those are efforts that where we come out and we try to help labor and management find ways to work together away from the bargaining table. It has been our experience over a number of decades that if we can help facilitate management and labor working together kind of away from the table, it enhances their ability to work cooperatively together when they're at the table. And so that's another third program of ours, and that's one I'll touch on a little bit later with regard to one of our change items. We very briefly have a couple of ancillary functions. The first one, we maintain a list of arbitrators that are used throughout the state whenever there is a dispute between a organized labor and a management group. We maintain that list. We also do training for both labor and management groups on ways that they can be more constructive and productive at the bargaining table. In your packet, you have a couple of change items for us, and I will just touch on those very briefly. The first is our request to increase the arbitrator fee. This is the fee that we charge individual arbitrators who are on the state's approved arbitration list. Currently, they pay $25, and that $25 allows them to be on the list for 3 years. That fee was set in the early 1980s and hasn't been changed since then. We would propose to raise that fee to $100 per year, which is in line with what other organizations that maintain lists of arbitrators do, most notably the AAA organization. The second change item is asking for $50,000 for each year of the biennium to add to our labor management grant program. That is a grant program that we use to further some of our labor management cooperative efforts. We provide grant money for startup and maintenance of organizations that are a conglomeration of organized labor groups and different management groups that come again to work together away from the bargaining table. With again the emphasis being that it has been our experience that if we can set up scenarios that these groups can work together and have some shared successes on things other than collective bargaining agreements, that enhances their ability to bargain collectively when they're at the table. So that's the second one. And the third one is a 2% compensation adjustment. That's a very brief and concise view of the agency. Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer whatever questions you or the committee may have of me.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions from the committee members?
Senator Metzen. Just to say that we've already confirmed this young man on the Senate floor a couple weeks ago. So,
thank you. I
interviewed
that.
Him, and so you, very good rating. So you voted for me. So, all you guys did it.
So, I appreciate that. Thank you.
So you think we should give him a budget then? Huh?
I think so.
I'd appreciate that as well.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to come and present.
Okay. What do we got next? The Accountancy Board? Welcome.
Good morning. I'm Doreen Frost, and I'm the Executive Director at the Minnesota Board of Accountancy. And just to combine the two presentations where there is an overlap, I'm also the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design. And I was told that, that's one name, seven professions.
Okay. Go ahead. Can you repeat it five times quickly?
I actually could. It's the best part I do. And with me is the chair of the Board of Architecture and Engineering, Mr. Harvey Harvilla, who is a professional engineer. Because both boards have been administratively combined only, not budget-wise, but administratively almost 2 years ago now, the Board of Accountancy merged administrative services with the Board of Architecture and Engineering with a gubernatorial order. So if you would indulge me, I think it would take a lot less time just to go over. Basically, the mission and vision of the board is, both boards, is to protect the public health, safety, and welfare for the various professions through the administration of the exam, licensing, and, of course, the enforcement portion. Our budget today does not have any change orders. It's pretty simple, with the exception of the 2% that has been recommended by the governor for increased cost of labor and various contracts. But I would like to just briefly discuss the two big things that the board have successfully done for both boards is to really go online and provide more of the services to the public in an e-government fashion. It's been very successful merging the administration of the two boards because we're able to pick from the strengths and weaknesses and sift and sort and make the most of the resources. The Board of Accountancy has 17,000 licensees, and the Board of Architecture and Engineering has 16,586. They're close to matching the 17,000. We, for the Board of Accountancy, bring in are pretty revenue neutral. The Board of Architecture and Engineering has just also gone through a legislative audit, and we are over recovering our fees. And at this point, there's been no discussion to reduce the licensing fees, but rather to look at the delivery of additional services that might be necessary.
Such as?
Really in the area of enforcement, once again. As the Department of Labor and Industry merged all of the building code officials, the fire marshals, and there's been lawsuits that haven't resulted with those two agencies. One of the things that we've seen that's changed is code officials are not reporting as many enforcement actions to our licensing board. Most of our complaints are coming in from the general public, where we used to rely also on the code officials to notify us if there was a practice without a license type case. And it's one of the things that we as a board need to go out and do, I think, a greater outreach now that code officials are primarily just enforcing code laws, which licensing laws is a separate arm and entity of that.
Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Frost, can you tell us how much overcapture there was?
We recover approximately $1 million in one fiscal year and 1.7 or 1.6. Our renewals are 120 every 2 years, and it's a biennial renewal. So we get $1 million, approximately a little less than $1 million 1 year, and 1.6, I believe, was the recovery for all seven, fiscal seven.
Thank you.
And then that is most of the money you use for the operation?
Appropriated back to us, I believe, for this fiscal year is $785,000.
And you talked about increased enforcement. Is that something that you would do from within?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Did you want to address the committee, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I just wanted to have a quick comment. Earlier you've been mailed.
Say your name for the record, please.
I'm sorry. I'm Harvey Harvala, Chair of the Architecture Engineer Licensure Boards. And just a quick comment. We have earlier sent each of you our newsletter, The Communicator, and defines us. Apparently the staff passed it out again. But that gives a brief overview, of some of our current activity on the board that defines some of our current rulemaking process and some of our recent enforcement actions and our mission to be responsive to the public. With that, we're open for additional questions.
Any further questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate the quick overview.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Barber Cosmetology Board. And I need a haircut, too.
Unfortunately, I can't give you one, so you don't want one from me. Mr.
She's a lawyer. You don't want her.
I know. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Gina Stouse, and I'm the Executive Secretary with the Board of Barber and Cosmetologist Examiners. I'm here to discuss the Governor's recommendations for our budget. A little history of the board. The Barber and Cosmetology Board merged in July of 2004. The Barber before was a standalone board, and Cosmetology was under the Department of Commerce. Currently, the board licenses over 40,000 people, businesses, as well as schools. We regulate all of that. Currently, our revenue is deposited into the general fund. Approximately $250,000 revenue is generated for barbers and $1.3 million for cosmetologists. Currently, our revenue is more than sufficient to cover the board's costs. We receive a direct appropriation from the general fund to cover the cost to operate the board. The two governor's recommendations I'll discuss in a little bit of detail here. The first one is $200,000 for two additional positions. This is above and beyond the current eight full-time staff we have. One would be an investigator for the board, and the other one would be a licensing coordinator. We need an investigator to be able to intake the complaints we receive that are jurisdictional and to process the complaints and complete any appropriate disciplinary action that the board determines. The licensing coordinator is to help out the other two licensing coordinators just in regards to processing our applicants as we receive many of them. The $200,000 will go to travel costs. The investigator will have to travel every so often to anywhere within the state of Minnesota to investigate the complaints we receive, as well as to cover space. We will need additional office space to house these two individuals. The money will also go to hearings for these contested cases, as well as assisting with online renewal fees. The second piece of the governor's recommendation is the $12,000 in fiscal year 08 and $25,000 in 09 just to cover anticipated salary increases at a rate of 2% for salary and fringe. So that's the if there are any questions that I can answer for you.
Just out of curiosity, these two new positions, who's doing the enforcement now?
Currently, we have four inspectors that inspect approximately 1,600 salons and shops each. So what happens is when our inspectors go out to these salons, if we find violations that rise to the level, for instance, an unlicensed worker or an unlicensed salon, the salon or barbershop has 10 days to respond to us to remedy the situation. This investigator would be the office facilitator to make sure that these salons and shops are actually responding within 10 days. So currently we do have four inspectors out there, each inspecting approximately 1,600 shops and salons.
And the reason for the new request is they're not getting to enough?
No, they're getting to enough. It's their 40 hours a week is taken up by just inspecting, going to each salon and barbershop, actually physically inspecting, and they leave an inspection report. And when they leave the inspection report, they don't have the time to actually come into the office to ensure that any complaints that rise to the levels, like I said earlier, such as unlicensed individuals, we need someone in the office to be able to process these to make sure they're getting licensed, and if they're not, it would further go on to our complaint committee if they refuse to get licensed.
And so because they're out in the field all the time, you need a couple people in the office to look at the reports. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Any other questions?
Just a comment.
Senator Metzen.
Thank you, Chairman Thomas. About 6 months ago, I was of the opinion to put the Board of Barbering back as a freestanding group. I was very disappointed in two, three issues. Back then, there was a death of a director, I believe, and that was part of the problem, I guess. But I made a number of phone calls day after day after day. No response, nobody calling me back. But since then, they've hired a new director. She's visited with me at least once and has convinced me, and I really believe it, that the department is working much better today than I believe it worked the last year or two, particularly about 6 months ago when I had a problem and I kept calling for about a month. But anyway, I think we're on the right track again, and I commend you for your leadership, so I'm not disturbed anymore.
Thank you.
But I think I had good reason to, and I think we had a good discussion about that, what was going on back then. But so anyway.
So are you confirming that they need more people in the office?
Well, maybe I'm making a case for you. You know, in a backhanded way of getting you more people. But yes, I truly believe they probably do need, but the people they administer that are go out and look at, yeah.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, yes, we have, I'm housed with all the other health licensing boards, even though I'm considered a non-health licensing agency, and we have the second most licensees in the building I work with, and probably one of the least staffed. So as he alluded to earlier, I've only been with the board since September, and just the nature of licensing and what we do, we get a lot of phone calls, and we need people there to help answer the questions of our licensees and potential licensees as well.
Okay. Yeah, because it's always nice to call a state agency and have a real person answer. So,
okay. I didn't have that experience.
You should try again just to see what happens. Okay. Because we don't have to approve this till Monday. Okay. All right. Any other questions, committee members? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't see Mr. Ledoux here, so Senator Solon, why don't you come forward? Welcome to the committee, Senator Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here. Mr. Chair, I have Senate File 1354, which provides a much-needed appropriation to support business development and job creation from what I refer to as homegrown businesses. Senate File 1354 would appropriate $500,000 over the biennium from the general fund to expand the capacity of the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund to help entrepreneurs start and grow their businesses in northeastern Minnesota. Since 1989, the Entrepreneur Fund has helped start, stabilize, or expand over 900 businesses, creating or retaining over 2,300 jobs in northeastern Minnesota. Its loan funds have made 450 loans totaling $6.6 million and have helped businesses leverage an additional $14 million in financing from public and private sources. Over 7,700 people have accessed the Entrepreneur Fund's business training and technical assistance services. Entrepreneur Fund services focus on creating successful business owners and healthy businesses. Training, technical assistance, and support are critical elements of business success. Remarkably, over 85% of the business owners, most of whom are startups, are still in business 2 years after receiving assistance. The Entrepreneur Fund helped the owners of Brigham Upholstery in Duluth transform their business from a custom upholstery job shop to a manufacturing facility. Brigham has, since the inception of Cirrus Aviation, provided the interior finishing for all Cirrus airplanes, and they now are producing about 700 a year. The Northeast Entrepreneur Fund is seeking state support to provide technical assistance and business training for very small startup businesses. These are enterprises that start with just a few jobs, but ultimately can support a family and in some cases grow into larger enterprises. For a modest investment, we can support these local entrepreneurs with the technical assistance that is necessary to get them started with a good business plan and help them find sources of financing that meet their business startup needs. We are talking about modest investments in these businesses in order to get them started with a firm foundation and good prospects for success. And today I have with me Mary Matthews, who is president of the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund, and Carol Willoughby, owner of Let the World Know of Duluth, who will testify briefly and answer any questions the committee may have.
Let's go first, Ms. Matthews.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today on behalf of Senate File 1574. As Senator Solon noted, the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund has a 17-year history of working with both startup and existing businesses. And even with the potential of large mining, paper, and energy projects on the horizon in northeastern Minnesota, we can't lose sight of the need to diversify our economic base and develop locally owned businesses and to grow our own entrepreneurial talent. The newsletter that's been passed out to you today, or the excerpt, has stories about Plum Bun Bakery in Ely and the Firelight Galleries in Virginia. And Carol Willoughby from Let the Whole World Know will talk in a few minutes. As an update for the story about Brigham Upholstery, what started as a father and son business today has 13 full-time employees and has a customer base that's expanded far beyond Cirrus Aviation. So these businesses do grow over time. Our request to you today has two parts. The first is to provide intensive technical assistance to 50 new and existing businesses in northeastern Minnesota to help them access financing in the next 2 years through the Entrepreneur Fund and other sources. Tying financing and technical assistance together, in our experience, greatly increases the potential that businesses will survive and thrive. The second part of our request would help launch the Northland Entrepreneur Development System, a regional initiative with more than 30 economic development and education partners. It's a 10-year strategy that would change how we as a region grow and nurture entrepreneurial talent. It has three elements. One, it would work with education and culture to create a supportive environment for entrepreneurship, work with K through 16 to introduce entrepreneurship early into the schools, to provide an alternative to youth, an alternative to employment for youth. It would create a service provider network that would provide efficiency for entrepreneurs to network existing service providers to ensure that entrepreneurs receive the right services at the right time. And third, it would add professional coaching to provide a professional, accountable resource for entrepreneurs who choose to grow their businesses. The money from this bill would be used to provide professional business coaching to 30 entrepreneurs in northeastern Minnesota, and we're prepared to begin to do this July. The this project or the funding from the state would, in our history, create at least 2.5 business, jobs per business, and it would serve 80 businesses. It would provide leverage of at least $2 for every dollar of state money to come from foundation and federal sources. I would ask your support for this bill and would be available to answer questions. Then I would like to introduce Carol Willoughby, whose business, Let the Whole World Know, is a long-term customer of the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund. Thank you.
Must be well-wired with a name like that. Go ahead.
I am. Thank you, Chairman, and members of the committee for letting me come here and speak. My name is Carol Willoughby. The name of my business is Let the Whole World Know, and I make signs and banners. I have worked with the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund since 1990, and as I have grown my business, they have held my hand for that amount of all of these years with both technical assistance and financing. As a result of working with the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund, I also was part of the planning committee for the entrepreneurial development system. And one of the things that I learned as a result of learning about this system is I myself have hired a professional coach to help me as I have continued to grow my business. Working with a coach, I've learned about leadership, and I've learned entrepreneurial skills, and both of those were the things that have helped me increase both in revenue and staff. And I also started a second business as a result of my first one, and with this coaching, we developed a second business called Window Doodads, and that is actually a manufacturing business. And we manufacture a product, and again, I found myself back at the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund needing more information and assistance, and then working even in a greater way with a coach that helped me with timelines and, again, increasing and enlarging my business. We now have a product that started out, it's still produced in our garage. We hire people in our area to produce and package this. We are now in 900 stores, and we have just been accepted by a major catalog that just came out this spring, and they've already gone into back order. I guess what I would love to see here is I would love to see other entrepreneurs get the opportunities that I've gotten in my business. I know I never could have taken all of these steps. The income and the folks we hire would never, ever have been possible if I didn't have guidance and help from folks like the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund and this type of economic agency who can help somebody who has an idea but doesn't necessarily have the entrepreneurial skills to develop that. And so I would urge you to support this bill as well. And if you have any questions, I would be glad to answer them. Thank you.
I was going to throw you a softball and ask you what you would do without them, but you already asked that question, so I don't have to ask it.
I would still be painting signs in my living room.
Okay. Any questions of the committee? Further comments? Senator Solon or Matthews? Or
Mr. Chair, this is just very important for northeastern Minnesota in helping small businesses get a start and providing the technical assistance necessary for them to continue to be successful.
I haven't been to the Plum Bakery, but I know quite a bit about the Firelight Galleries, and it's a pretty interesting store. So if you want some upscale stuff that is really, really nice for your home, it's a really, really nice place. And Rosie's done a great job there. So
she has.
Okay. So
Mr. Chairman, can I add one quick
Ms.
thing?
Ms. Matthews.
Mr. Chairman, when Carol came to us in 1990, nobody in her family had ever run a business. And today her husband works with her full-time in the business, and she has two children. Her daughter has started a home-based graphics business of her own, and her son is an electrician who, while he's working for somebody now, plans at some point to start his own business. So this has multi-generational impact, So it has additional impacts beyond the initial business. So thank you.
Ms. Matthews, how does this $500,000 help you or change what you're doing?
It would expand what we're doing in give us more funds to do our existing technical assistance. The piece that would really change would be the regional implementation of the system, where we would be adding professional coaching to the resources that are currently available in the region. What we want to do is grow entrepreneurs' skills. The analogy is... I know I don't want to take up too much of your time, but the analogy is thinking about the way professional sports teams grow, hockey in your instance, and thinking about how rarely does someone, when they're born, have the capacity to play in a professional hockey league. But they start in peewees, and they receive professional support and professional coaching up through school, into college hockey, and then up into semi-pros. And so we want to add professional accountable coaching in our region that would help people grow their skills so that we could create some major league entrepreneurs in northeastern Minnesota.
So what you're saying is that if there had been a Northeast Entrepreneurial Fund coach available for me when I was younger, I could have made the NHL?
You might have made the NHL of business.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Okay, then Senator Solon, we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you all
thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Who's here? Senator Metzen, are you ready to do your bill?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Senator Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 1458 deals with the Bioscience Business Development and Commercialization Grants Program. The problem is the Bio Business Alliance of Minnesota, after conducting their statewide assessments of bioscience industry, found that one of the Minnesota's weaknesses was the reduction of small startup company activity. What we need to do is improve getting all these great ideas and proposals to market. The bill is designed to help with the small startup company activities in this industry. These grants would be administered through the deed. Again, it would help the smaller bioscience companies. Oftentimes, research gets developed to a point that gets the lower risk factor, but then we need these entrepreneurs to pick up these ideas and carry them on. But with me is Phil Griffin, and he will I was told we have 2.5 minutes, so... Is that too long?
I respect you, Senator. Benson, so you can, what as long as you got exactly the same two witnesses as I had for my bill, could you guys tell me how Senator Metzen's bill and my bill might interact with each other?
Phil Griffin with Life Science Alley, we would be happy to try and describe that.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, members, I am Phil Griffin. I represent Life Science Alley, which is a trade association of over 500 businesses here in Minnesota that are in the bioscience and life science world. We're here today, as Senator Metzen described, with a proposal to try and give grant money to the Department of Economic Development so that we can help to spin out the technology that's been developed. And as Mr. Wallstrom, who's the president and CEO of the Business Alliance, will describe for you, this is something that we think stands a great chance of providing job growth in Minnesota, and he can give you more information about that. But as we've been talking to the legislature over the last few years, Life Science Alley has brought together a proposal or set of proposals that we think will help to move our industries along. strong. It is a four-pronged approach. One of them is that we need to support education in the state. And you as legislators should be very proud of the work that you've done in supporting K-12 and the University of Minnesota and Minsky systems to produce the kind of highly qualified, highly educated workers that we need. The second piece that we need is research, and the research money that's gone into the Academic Health Center, to the alternative fuels system over at the University of Minnesota, and I could go on about the genomics partnership with Mayo. These are really good ideas that are working to develop great ideas. But the third thing that we need, and the one that we are here about today, is to try and put some seed money in for economic development, and that's where that intertwines with your bill, Mr. Chairman. The idea of trying to get tax credits to people is one that's a great one that we're taking through the Tax Committee for the biosciences. Your bill, which relates to funding the BioBusiness Alliance, they will be doing an ongoing research map to try and map out for us what other states have done, which is set up maps on how we are going to proceed with investments so that our neighbors in Wisconsin are investing $700 million into this world, and we think that that makes sense. The bill that you have before you is a fairly simple one. It provides $5 million to try and take off of the shelf of companies that have developed technologies that don't meet with their business plans a way of getting those out into the community. It sets up a task force to review those within DEED and then has that money expire only after it's been spent on the one-time appropriation. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn over to Mr. Wallstrom, who heads the BioBusiness Alliance, which you'll recall was spun off from the Governor's Bioscience Advisory Council and set up as a private 501c3. It is money that is being matched with private sector money when we bring your appropriation in here. And Mr. Wallstrom has recently retired from Medtronic, where he headed one of the major divisions there, and can describe to you more fully the work that they're doing.
Before we go to Mr. Wallstrom, Mr. Griffin, is Wisconsin trying to develop some kind of chip to put in the cows or something so they get more milk, or what's the deal?
Mr. Chairman, they have a fairly broad research program that's going on at the state level that includes not only major funding of new biosciences work at the University of Wisconsin system, but also economic development money that's going into a lot of things. We're just hoping that it doesn't add seats to Lambeau Field.
They're getting Randy Moss, I hear. Anyway, Mr. Wallstrom, welcome again to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni and committee members. First, I would add that there actually is a startup company in Wisconsin that is looking at putting chips in the cows to improve milk output. We've talked to them a couple times, and it's quite intriguing.
But they got more cows than people in some of their counties. So
yes, what I'm here for, and in front of you there's a handout. I'd like to start with the graph and provide two quick handouts for context, or slides for context. The first one shows a graph of titled Statewide Industry Assessment, Biobusiness Employment. We've presented to this committee before the results of our assessment that we did last year. We published last August. And just to refresh everybody's memory of the 11 states that we looked at, in this area of business, of biobusiness, which is a high-growth, double-digit growth industry right now, we were the only state that we looked at that lost jobs. These are also very high-paying jobs. They average about $26,000 more per job than the average industry sector type of job. It's a 10,000-year-old industry. However, from a commercialization perspective, it's really coming into maturity now. It's really reached its maturity now. On slide number two, you flip over some of the critical needs that we identified in that process that the state needs to think about. And when I say state, I don't mean only state government. I mean private sector as well as state, local government, and academic sector are blocked into these three categories. One is catalyze and support startup and new businesses and medical devices and keep them here. And number two, catalyze R&D and life sciences, which is the high-growth industry right now. And then number three is work on a sustainable renewable industry for the state. The bill that is being presented here today deals with the second bullet under item number one and the first item under category number two. So it's targeted at the commercialization of private sector knowledge and the creation of small companies. And as has already been presented on the next page, it's Senate File 1458. The primary focus of this is the provision to provide for small grants, and we're not talking about large grants. We're talking about relatively small grants to try to incent companies to let go of their intellectual property and allow it to be commercialized. And if you turn to the last page, where there's a graph called the Pipeline of Private Sector Technology Commercialization, there's a few points I'd like to make on this, and this is why this is important. This is a new industry. There's a lot of startup activity going on. If you look at the left side of that flow diagram, every time a new idea comes forward, it goes through a basic research step, concept assessment, risk mediation, and then market potential is established. We call that area the Valley of Death because of approximately 90% of the ideas that are initiated don't make it to that center line, which is called the internal annual review process. And what happens with inside of large companies, small companies, is that many ideas are seeded. Those seeds start on the left-hand side. Over the course of months to decades, in some cases, these ideas take 15, 20 years to get to the point of knowing whether they will be ready for commercialization. And in fact, in the area of biotech, it usually is in a 15 to 20-year time frame. And the cost is somewhere between $200,000 to $20, $30 million, somewhere in that range. It's a huge investment. Once it reaches that internal review, all these seeds reach the internal review process inside of an organization, the company will decide which ones do we take forward and which ones do we not take forward. To take it from that approval step all the way to market release is about 3 to 10 years. And will cost somewhere between $5 million and $1 billion in revenue, or in cost, rather. It's at the end of this period of time frame that job creation really begins to occur. When you start with a whole new idea, that total cycle time can take anywhere from a few years to 2 to 3 decades. If you once you start with this internal annual review process selection, it can take relatively short amount of time. It can be as little as 3 years. This is why we are trying to incent, this bill is targeted at trying to incent a company that instead of taking that technology and putting it back on the shelf, the ones that are not commercialized, to take it forward and commercialize it. That's really the essence. The point being that by doing that, we can begin to generate jobs almost immediately. In fact, when one of these tasks or one of these companies is spun out, the job creation literally starts the next day in the form of a management team.
Thank you.
And that's...
You know, I'm just trying to... It seems like this is an industry that is... I mean, the potential is unlimited. And we definitely got to get into it. I'm trying to figure out if... Because we've got about 4 or 5 bills that pertain to it. All... apparently seem to be addressing something different, but all trying to get to the same place. Is there a way to, for example, I got a couple of bills, Senator Metzen's got a couple of bills, Senator Rosen's got a bill. Is there a way to just kind of combine this into one big chunk and let you guys go at it? Do we actually need to parcel them out the way they are and have them aimed at certain things?
Mr. Chairman, Phil Griffin again with Life Science Alley. I'd say that they are all good ideas, and I know that that's a very difficult thing for the legislature in terms of trying to pick out which ones are good. I know we have colleagues in the room who are representing the UEL, the University Enterprise Laboratory, which is another great idea and incubator space for doing this. The plea that we would give you, and we know that funds are limited, clearly we could chew up the entire state budget were we to be given the authority to impose taxes. But these are important issues, and we are lagging behind what's going on in other states. Senator Metzen's committee had the opportunity to hear from Mr. Wallstrom on the entire report that they did looking at the background. And there are other states that are investing, as I mentioned, Wisconsin, but hundreds of millions of dollars. The proposals that we're bringing to you, we think, are tailored to meet Minnesota's unique position in the fact that we've already developed, as Mr. Wallstrom has described, some of the basis for this in the research efforts that we've done at the University of Minnesota. We think that this particular proposal is uniquely positioned in terms of its ability to take those things that have already been put on the shelves because they don't meet with a business plan for a current company. Much of the research has been developed, and when you pull them off the shelf, you can immediately create jobs with those.
I think my point is, though, that this bill, for example, has a $1.2 million appropriation, and I think I had a bill that had a $2.2 million appropriation, and there's another bill that has a $600 million or $600,000 appropriation. If instead of saying this amount of money is needed for this particular bill or this amount of money is needed for this particular bill, and we just said, okay, here's $20 million for biosciences or whatever the number is, would these needs be taken care of inherently in the fact that they're all aimed at the same thing? I mean, for example, you might find out that Senator Metzen's bill actually needs $3 million instead of $1.2, and here you don't have it, whereas if you had a big pot of money to get it from, the possibility would be that that's where we got to aim it at as opposed to limiting it to this. Am I getting this wrong? I might be.
Senator, I would I guess my nickel would be this, that I think that one of the things that we've talked about before to this committee is the need for a statewide plan. And then one of the bills that affect the bill that you're sponsoring with us is targeted just at that. It's called Destination 2025. We need some sort of a vision that helps to set direction for the state so that all of these funding requests can be put into some kind of context. And all the organizations, I believe everyone that has, I'm assuming I know all the bills, I'm not sure that's correct, but assuming that I do, I think all of these bills all fit together very nicely. They're not competitive, they all fit a specific need. The question is timing, the question is amount. One thing I can say unequivocally, that the amount of money that I'm aware of that we're asking for is very small compared to what our competitors are putting into this area. So we would ask, of course, we will ask that some kind of priority be given to this evolving industry that's taking off right now like a rocket. And right now we are not participating in it. And we need to do something to engage that. So that being said, because I'm relatively new to this process, I don't understand all the intricacies of how you could quickly get these kinds of groups aligned within the next, I assume, weeks. That'd be quite a challenge. I think would be hard. That being said, long term, that's exactly what needs to happen because we will never have enough money to do everything everybody wants to do. We're going to have to focus it and be very precise about how we spend it so that we maximize the outcome.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I'm thinking here is that
Chairman, maybe there's a way, not sure if there is a way, but in the next couple of weeks or so, maybe pull the players together, if you will, and maybe, you know, we'll talk about that, and maybe it's not possible, but maybe it is possible. But we do know the importance of this bill here, and we're lagging way behind the world, not just the nation, on this kind of stuff, so we've got to catch up. But there might be a way to bring them together. I don't know if that's possible. But okay. Well, we can look at it.
You want to say something, Senator Kubley?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not really a question, I guess. I just wanted to add a word of support for this bill. I think, you know, this is the kind of industry that really is kind of an emerging area in our economy right now, and it really develops a lot of other spinoff jobs in relation to it. So, and most of those jobs are going to pay you know, significantly above average. So it does seem to me that this is something that we need to pursue. Thanks to Senator Metzen for bringing this forward. I think it's really something that we need to give serious consideration. I know, you know, money is short, but I think we need to do what we can for this area just because of the spinoff implications that it does have.
And I agree totally. I'm just wondering if we're better off not putting a pot of money out there, because, like I said, this particular bill might actually generate a whole bunch of businesses if it had more money available to it, as opposed to just this amount of money that we're looking at here. And so I don't...
This, Mr. Chairman, just to follow up.
I'm looking at the wrong bill. I'm sorry. He's looking at the $10 million bill. Oh.
But this leverages a lot of, like Senator Coobley said, spin-off stuff, and the money that they could raise if we get this money for the startup. It's
twice this week I've looked at the wrong
pretty bill. High. But this is the future. I mean, so.
Okay, but you understand what I'm thinking.
We're tracking together. I know there's four or five. I've got a couple of issues, and you have, and Senator Rosen has been involved in this bioscience stuff, and maybe there's a way for a marriage. I don't know if it can be done.
Okay.
But we'll look at it.
Any other comments? Seeing none, then we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Metzen, you've got another bill. As long as you're up there, you might as well do that.
Yeah.
That was the one I was just looking at.
I have who's
looking for... Mike Bingham, is he here? And Andrea Corbett? All right.
Are they not here? Or
I guess they're not here. I don't know if they're coming either. But do you have this handout?
You have that?
Anywhere?
There? What's that? What's that right there?
I wonder if... I think I can handle it, all right. But this is... Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 175 deals with job training program grants to Twin City Rise. This is a program that primarily employers work with skilled workers or try to create workers from the of color, and 58% of the people in this program are of color, and a lot of them, the office is in North Minneapolis. It works with low-income adults who face multiple barriers to employment, who are underemployed or unemployed. They provide long-term comprehensive training that will lead to living wage jobs. The program includes a combination of classroom training, ongoing coaching, off-site technical training, and other supportive services. The program is on its merits is very good today, but before the budget division, I think you may also be very interested in the way that the program is funded. They are funded based on their results. That's a very important point to make. They are paid the state funds only after they have documented successful placement in the job community. This RISE program really works, and it's not a handout. It's a proven. Maybe I'll pass this around and let you kind of look at what they're doing. And let's stay out. We get back to the accountability and innovation of this program and how they the success stories. We had a gentleman the other day in the committee I chair was incarcerated and didn't think he had any hope at all, but he got into this RISE program, and I tell you what, it was quite a story that he told, and it just brought to light the kind of things that that they do. And again, if you could save a few people, but they've done a lot of saving, if you will, of people, and brought them from down and out to real jobs, and it works. So I think if it's necessary, we'll talk about including this, but if we need more... committee members need more on this, I'll be happy to get these brochures to you, and I just don't know why they weren't here today or why the people aren't here, but it does work, and if we can look at it in the next couple of days, and I'll convince you further if I can that this thing works, and it's
And Senator Metz, I think this already has some base funding, and just based on the brochure I'm looking at, and I'll pass it around too, it looks like it, the dollars invested give back a lot.
It's a very successful story, and I just wish that I had a couple of my witnesses here that were here before.
You're such a credible author, you probably don't even need the witnesses, you know, so.
You know, you're kind of being nice to me today. You had a couple of tough days with you, but now I think we're, it's cool by you.
Some mornings you get up, you know, you feel
you were, had your nasty pill the other morning, but you're on, that's fine. But this, I'm just kidding. You've been very fair, but if you feel you need more, but this, it works. It really works.
Okay, then Senator Metz will lay over Senate File 157 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much.
Commissioner Ledoux, why don't you? You're still a commissioner, right?
Yes.
Yes, I can.
Commissioner.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for.
Looks like you're still in pretty good shape.
Give me the time. Well, I try and stay in shape, but you know, as you get older, the other day I was running into the wind, and a leaf blew by me. So, you know, I wasn't going real fast, you know. But it's
pretty challenging. You're one of those guys who acts like you're running, but you're really walking?
you swing your arms like you're running.
He's got the Boxing Commission, just so everybody knows.
Yes, I'm the executive director of the Boxing Commission, and we've come forward to trying to explain how we're going to, you know, be self-sufficient if we can be by 2008. One of the things is we're going to raise all our fees. We have a bill right now it's in both House and Senate to raise the fees across the board to the officials that are working in the boxing game. And along with that, we have the promoter's license is only $400 for a promoter. He can promote 5-6 shows in a year, but $400. What we're proposing is to have a event fee, which is $1,500 each time he has an event, because in the past, before the commission was reinstated, they were paying a commission to come in, and they were paying them $2,000 to come in and plus their expenses. So we're adding to an event fee of $1,500 so we can, you know, to try and get some more money in for to, you know, control our budget. Along with that, we have worked out some programs where we're trying to get UFC, which has approached me. They've asked, and UFC is down in Las Vegas under the Boxing Commission in Las Vegas. And UFC, now they're selling franchises. And we had a young man approach me, and we had a meeting, and UFC would like us to oversee and have oversight over those matches. And I think that that's a good opportunity. They have committed to a percentage of their gates to give to us as a commission to oversee their matches. And also, we're trying to get in the bill MMA, mixed martial arts, of which we're trying to get. There is no oversight for mixed martial arts or UFC right now. There's no committee or commission that, you know, has any power over them. And I think it's unfortunate for the state that we need to get some oversight and make sure that they're doing following the rules and doing the right thing. In the past years, when the commission was back in existence, it was around $80,000 to $85,000 a year, and we have now been budgeted to $50,000 a year, and we're trying to hang on with that. At this point in time, since last July, I've worked out of my home, and I've used my own computers and my own phones and getting things done, and that's because of the love of the game. I was injected with the disease 40 years ago, and I can't get rid of it. And there's no 12-step program, so it's a real issue for me. One of the things, in the past, when I was a commissioner for 18 years, we had 18 different shows. And if we can get back up to that volume, yes, we will have a great opportunity of covering our budget, along with the fact in the last three shows, we have done an estimate with an accountant. Our three shows that we did, the sales tax alone for the state paid for the budget, for our boxing commission. And it was amazing what we've done. We had 9,000 people at the Target Center last month, and it was just wonderful to have that kind of crowd. And do you think that they might spend a few dollars on a couple hot dogs and a little beer and a little supper afterwards and some hotels? Yes. And it's been very good for our state and good for our sport. And I think that's important to recognize, along with all the other things that go along with that, as far as parking and those kinds of issues. It's been a great thing for our state and to bring boxing back. And I think it's really exciting that we have those kind of opportunities. And next month, we have two shows, one at the Target Center and one at Roy Wilkins, both of which will be on national television. One will be on Showtime on the April 6th card. That'll be on Showtime television. And the next one is April 25th at Roy Wilkins, which will be on ESPN, which I was a broadcaster with for 5 years. And it's a great opportunity for ESPN to come back in, because the last time they did a show here, I believe it was, I'm trying to remember. It's got to be 3 years ago. They did a show, and Teddy Atlas, who is the color commentator at that for that event, he went off on Minnesota and, blasting the fact that we had no commission and that our fights were horrible and we had horrible decisions. I'm really excited about bringing ESPN back in to show them that we have cleaned up our act and that we have a good commission in place, and we have we're following the rules and making sure that boxing is well taken care of, and especially in the part of safety. Safety is our number one rule for any fighter, and on that particular card, they had a fighter on the card who had a 14-64 record. He had 14 wins and 64 losses. We would not let him cross the border when Jimmy O'Hara was in charge. Jimmy O'Hara would say, hey, we're not letting this guy fight in our state. I mean, how many times is he going to get knocked out before he gets hurt, And so we don't allow those kind of fighters in. And the last three shows we've had have been excellent fights. We've had no knockouts. We've had TKOs, but no knockouts. And it's just been a wonderful thing. And we've had some good fighters. And I've been very blessed to be in the game for 40 years and get an opportunity to watch fighters and learn how to make matches. I watched Jimmy O'Hara. He would work with me and say, okay, look at this guy's record and tell me what you think. And I'd say, well, I don't think it's a good match. He'd say, but you got to look at the guy's record, who he's fought, and how many times he's been stopped. And that's the key. Myself, I've had 50 fights. I had 12 losses. Wait a minute. People say, he's a bum. 11 of them were world champions. So that's what you got to look at. That's what you have to look at, the fighters, who they fought, cross-reference them. And we've had some great fights in the last three shows, and it's been exciting. And that's part of the issue with safety with boxing. And without safety in boxing, we're in trouble. And that's really the key.
You fought 11 guys that became world champs?
Pardon me?
You fought 11 guys that became world champs?
I fought twice for the title. I fought Mike Weaver for the title in Met Sports Center in 1978, lost a 12-round decision. And then in 1980, I fought Larry Holmes for the title. And I got stuck with a thumb in my eye, tore my retina, and got the fight stopped. I always say the good news is I was never knocked out. The bad news is I remember everything. I was fortunate enough to fight. I fought George Foreman in 1976. I boxed Ali and Spinks in 77. I fought Weaver for the title in 78. I fought Norton to a draw at the Met Sports Center in 1979. Knocked him down twice. He went to the hospital. I went to a great party. Who won? You know. Then I fought Holmes in 1980 for the title. 81, I fought Coetzee. 82, I fought Page. 83, I fought Bruno. Bruno was the only guy to give me frequent flyer miles in the ring. But a big, strong guy, and he was...
Did you beat him?
Bruno? Pardon me?
Did you beat Bruno?
No, I got stopped on a cut eye over in the third round.
But
as I was flying through the air after he hit me with the left hook, I was thinking... But it was
one of 3 miles that way, I get it.
Yeah, freaking flyer miles. But it was interesting, after the fight, the press asked me, they said, do you think you could have beaten Frank Bruno when you first started? And I said, of course I would. Well, he said, "What makes you think so?" I said, he was 4 years old when I started. I would have killed a kid, you know. And along with that, I went, 10 years after I retired, I went and trained with Mike Tyson for 2 months. I have both ears that showed I was real quick. And in 2001, I trained with Lennox Lewis. So those are the 11 world champions I was in a ring with. And it's given me a great view of boxing, a great vision, and the 40 years of experience I've had. It's been wonderful. I started boxing in 66. I did my last boxing event last October. I boxed Jerry Cooney for Wishes and More. We raised $26,000 for the charity. And it was a great event. We had a great turnout, and it was really fun. That's my last time in the ring. Last time. 40 years is enough.
I was going to tell you, you better stop.
Well, I always say that this is my last time because I still remember my name and how to get home. Time to quit.
And we got Jungle Boy Zach Walters coming up now.
Wonderful fighter. Yeah. Tough young man. A very nice young man.
Yeah.
He's just a wonderful kid.
Is he on any of the cards that are coming
He
up?
Was on the card at the Target Center. And he's just fought recently up in Superior.
Yeah, my kid's
and
out of that.
He'll be coming on the cards, yes.
Okay. Senator Kubley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think you may not be aware of it, but Mr. Ledoux is almost single-handedly responsible for bringing some organization and some safety back into the sport here in Minnesota. I think when we did this bill a couple of years ago, he was really the only promoter of the safety issue, and it made a big impact on the committee and decided that we needed to put the Boxing Commission back in place because it does generate income for the state and it does have the opportunity to pay for itself, as Mr. Ledoux has pointed out. But he was really a strong advocate for organizing the sport once again and bringing some safety issues back into the ring. So we'd like to say thanks for that.
Well, thank you very much. It's a labor of love because I love the game. And obviously the state of Minnesota loves the game. To think that we had 9,000 people at the Target Center and after only a couple months of getting boxing back, I hope my goal is to break my records. I hold the top 10 gate receipt and attendance records. I want those broken. You know, when I fought Dwayne Bobic, we drew 14,000 people at the Met Sports Center. I think those amounts will be way passed over. I'm really excited. We have a lot of good young fighters in our state that weren't given a chance to fight here up until recently. You know, we have a heavyweight up in Coon Rapids named Joey Abel. I used to box with Joey all the time, and now he got a new trainer. I don't even want to be in the same gym with him because he hits so hard. I mean, man, he hit me so hard one day, my ancestors in France felt it. But.
Okay. We know we want this guy. All right. Okay.
Any questions?
I don't think so. Any further questions of the committee or comments?
Senator, you oversee the martial arts and the kickboxing and all of those other.
We haven't done. That's what there is no group that's overseeing that, and that's what we need to do. And part of our issue is with doing that, we bring in revenue from officials and stuff like that, and the promoters. There's right now they have nobody, and they're answering to no one.
Why, Mr. Chairman, why can't, would your group and board, and would you be able to do that if you had the authority?
Yes.
Somebody's got to oversee that kickboxing. I mean,
yes.
You're talking about safety and things there.
Yes, exactly.
I've seen some of that stuff, but somebody's got to be looking over it. Why don't we have legislation to authorize you or somebody to overlook?
Well, that's what we're putting in. We're putting
is that
the bill.
In your bill?
It's in the bill
right now.
To oversee MMA and UFC.
Right.
And in Las Vegas, the Boxing Commission oversees that.
Okay,
and the UFC is now, they've started selling franchises, and it's their first franchise, first time they ever had a UFC match out of Las Vegas was in Ohio. They sold it out, 18,000 people. And so it's an exciting event, and people are looking forward to it. So it's an MMA, they've held them here. Tough Man, we're overseeing Tough Man. At this point in time, Tough Man hasn't come forward to ask if they can do fights because they know that the rules they have to follow now, because we're going to be officials at the event, and we're not going to allow anybody going into the ring who's been drinking. And that's what's been going on in the past with Tough Man bouts. People have been in the bar drinking, and we're not going to let that happen.
They didn't start a barroom brawl before they got there, did they?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Of course, I know about those. I remember when I was ranked 6th in the world, I was ranked 17th at the bar I hung out in. It's a tough joint.
Good match. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Good job. Senator Cohen.
Chairman, members. Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 557 is a bill that allows for state support for St. Paul's River Center debt as well as the Xcel Energy debt. And Mr. Chairman, members, let me just kind of lay the groundwork. I've got Mayor Coleman with me and Mr. O'Meara, who is on the River Center Authority. Obviously, a lot of discussion over the last several years about state support for what are considered significant aspects of local economic development. And certainly one of those efforts, or one of those opportunities exists with the St. Paul River Center. In introducing this legislation, Mr. Chairman, members, my intent was to do a little bit of apples and apples. The state is providing some significant support for convention centers throughout the state. Obviously, we have legislation authored this year, or over the last couple of years, relative to the Duluth DEC. We had support in 1998 for the Minneapolis Convention Center. We'll have legislation next year for a couple of other convention centers. And what's happened, I think, is that St. Paul, maybe by virtue of being a little bit of a victim of its own success, has not had the opportunity for some of that same support. But, Mr. Chairman and members, what's happened is St. Paul, which has the River Center and the Xcel Energy Center, which are significant. You know, we always talk about, you know, is this something of statewide significance? Is this something that has an impact beyond the borders of the particular city? What's striking now about St. Paul is these buildings will have an impact not simply beyond the borders of St. Paul and not beyond the borders of the state of Minnesota, but with the Republican National Convention, will have an impact nationally, if not internationally, next year when you have the convention in St. Paul. So what we're attempting to do, and what's happened is where other cities have had significant support from the state, St. Paul has not. And the debt load has become quite significant for St. Paul, a mid-sized town. And so this legislation makes a request for some of the same support that the state legislature has been offering to other cities around Minnesota. So, Mr. Chairman, if I could have some testimony from Mayor Coleman, and Mr. O'Meara would appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you, Senator Cohen. Welcome to the committee, Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Chris Coleman, Mayor of St. Paul. I appreciate Senator Coleman or Cohen bringing this Coleman. We've adopted him here. Two Irishmen flanking him on either side here.
I can tell some stories about the mayor when he was 7 years old.
I would prefer that he didn't. We do have a very unique asset in the city of St. Paul. The River Center complex includes the XL Energy Center, the River Center Convention Center, the parking ramp, and the Roy Wilkins Auditorium, as well as the Ordway Theater. When you combine all of those elements, you really have an incredible economic driver in the city of St. Paul. Yesterday, I was at a press conference for Pheasants Forever. Pheasants Forever is an organization that's nationwide, but it was founded in the city of St. Paul. They're going to have their national convention in January of 2008 that will bring 25,000 people from around the United States and the 700 chapters across the United States into the city of St. Paul. It's because of the uniqueness of the asset that we are able to attract an event like that. In addition to that, obviously you're familiar with the national convention coming to St. Paul in the fall of 2008. When we bid on both of the parties' national convention, both of the parties were interested in it because the River Center complex is a unique asset and is unlike any other convention center in the entire country. But it is it's a great asset. It's a great economic driver. But it is, as Senator Cohen suggested, because of the financial burden that is on the facility right now, I think our ability to maintain that as a first-class center is becoming increasingly impacted. In most of the cities, these type of facilities are separated. You don't have a convention center next to an arena that can host an event like the convention. But it is the synergy of that arrangement, again, with the Ordway and all the different amenities in St. Paul, that has allowed us to see the kind of activity that you have. You got the WCHA tournament down there this week. You had the state high school hockey tournament there last week. You had not only the games and the XL, but then you had the hockey expo next door, and it was just a tremendous driver for the city of St. Paul. We're pleased that this is happening, but we have an aging facility in parts of it. The Roy Wilkins is an old 5,000-seat facility that is still used. You just heard Commissioner Ledoux talking about the boxing matches that he hopes to attract that would bring national attention to the state of Minnesota and to the city of St. Paul if they can get ESPN back into the facility. But that facility was built in 1932. I've had a lot of memories in there over the year, good ones and bad ones. I think I took the bar exam there, although I tried to get that out of my head as quickly as I could. It needs some significant upgrading in order to be able to make it integrated more fully with the facility and help us optimize that asset. Because of the debt load, we have to use a lot of our operating revenue right now just to pay debt service. And it puts us in a different position relative to any other facility in the state. It makes it very difficult for us to market the facility. It makes it very difficult for us to do upgrades, and it makes it difficult for us to do some basic things that we think would allow us to attract even more conventions. One of the great things about having a national convention in your town is we've talked with other cities that have hosted both the Republican and the Democratic national conventions, and they have said that once you have hosted an event like this, you can host any event anywhere of any size that would be interested in a facility like this. You could have national events and international events. But our ability to capitalize on that will be significantly impinged unless, A, we can market it, and, B, continue to upgrade it to have that kind of first-class, world-class facility. With that, Senator Cohen kind of referenced the uniqueness of our financial situation relative to other convention centers. The parallel between the Convention Center relief in Minneapolis just a few years ago, facilities in Rochester, Bemidji, Duluth, and other cities. We believe that the debt relief for the River Center is extremely important for us to be able to capitalize on the asset that we have and build it even bigger and better so that we can attract people to the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mayor.
Mr. Chairman, if I could ask Mr. O'Meara to testify for.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Cohen, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Seamus O'Meara. I am a River Center board member and its immediate past co-chair. Mayor Coleman and Senator Cohen are correct. We have a unique integrated campus between the River Center, the XL Energy Center, Roy Wilkins, the Ordway, with close proximity to the Science Museum in Rice Park. If you've been down there, it's a fantastic area. We host a number of significant events between these facilities, and we bring in numerous visitors into St. Paul and into Minnesota by virtue of having those facilities there. Our ability to bring in these events is regional significance, brings about regional significance to Minnesotans, not just to St. Paul. And it is those events and that significance that we are coming here to ask for a long-term financial platform in order to provide security, maintenance, long-term capital improvements. We have a parking ramp facility that will need to be probably torn down and replaced in the intermediate future. We draw most of our revenue from that source. And so we're looking, Mr. Chair, for a platform for us to continue to bring in the Pheasants Forever that will bring in 25,000 members to St. Paul and to Minnesota, to bring in the U.S. Visa Championships, to bring in the U.S. Figure Skating Championships, to draw from our GOP Republican Convention in 2008, and to continue to deliver these type of events with a world-class facility with the type of improvements that we need to provide and the type of security and maintenance that people have come to know in St. Paul.
Thank you. Seamus O'Meara. You should have a brighter green tie on, I think.
Well, it's the day before. I've been practicing.
Okay. You know, when your name is Seamus O'Meara, you really don't have to advertise.
That's probably true. What's with the parade?
What do you mean, what's with it?
I heard we're not having a parade this year.
That's St. Cloud.
Oh, it was St. Cloud.
We will be parading tomorrow,
okay,
sir.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, we have others who can testify, including Matt Smith, I believe is here, who is the finance director for St. Paul. If members have questions about the particular finances and how some of the debt servicing is being handled. And we can have testimony from Mr. Smith if members would like to do that.
Senator Cohen, that's up to you. If you would like to get that on the record, that'd be fine.
Okay. Well, possibly. I thought I saw Mr. Smith somewhere right behind. And Mr. Chairman, obviously, Mr. Smith testifies in front of us occasionally, and I think members recall that he was the Commissioner of Revenue in both Governor Carlson's administration and Governor Ventura's administration, and is now the finance director for the city of St. Paul.
Was he supportive of the original bonding when it came through the legislature and he was in the finance department?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I wanted him to answer that. To be fair, Commissioner Wheelock was probably more involved.
Yes, okay. That's right.
That's not here.
I know I voted for it, so I mean, okay.
Mr. Chairman and members, just to briefly give you the sense about the whole River Center campus that was described and the
just say your name for the record.
I'm sorry. I'm Matt Smith, the Director of Finance for the City of St. Paul. There are really, on the entire complex that you see around the River Center campus, there's really four separate debts. There's, first of all, there's debt on the arena itself, which are bonds that the City of St. Paul sold to finance the actual arena itself. Those arena bonds are not what's before you today. The other three components of debt are the ones that are addressed in Senator Cohen's bill. An additional state loan that was made to complete the financing for the arena, for which the city is obliged to pay $1.5 million per year back to the state. Secondly, the Convention Center, River Center bonds, which were used to finance the Convention Center facility itself, where the debt payment is $4.5 million a year. And the third component is debt on the parking ramp, which is $900,000 a year. And so those last three components are the debts that are relieved in this bill.
Okay. All right. And this, Senator Cohen, this is all one-time money in this bill, right?
Chairman, that's correct. So what I'm hoping the committee will do is make a recommendation in the one-time bill you're going to send to the Finance Committee.
I understand.
Is my request.
Did you give me enough money to be able to do this?
It's a
to do this.
You don't have to, Chairman, you don't have to answer that, Senator Cohen.
I was hoping it was at the top of your list.
Well, there is a big number at the top of my list, that's for sure. Okay. Any questions from the committee or any further comments from anybody in the audience? Senator Cohen, do you want any final comments?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the witnesses have indicated what the merits are, what the need is, and I think in all honesty, what I'm asking the legislature to do is to treat St. Paul as we're treating many other similar facilities around the state, or similar cities around the state with comparable facilities. And St. Paul had hoped, and we're coming at this in the middle of the process, in effect, not at the start of the process. You know, we had thought that there would be the opportunity for us, with utilization of the half-cent sales tax, as other cities have done, to pay off the debt service. But it's become very, very difficult. That's not a secret to anybody that we've had the testimony relative to that. We continue to use the half-cent sales tax. That's not going to go away. But we're looking for similar support to what we're doing for everybody else.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any, Senator Metzen, you have any comments?
No, I'm just listening.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to comment that we supported, a lot of us, the XL Center a few years back, and in my opinion, it's one of the best. A lot of the good things have happened in St. Paul, but that's added a lot. I don't know how many events you have there a year, 150, 200, but it's kind of brought, in my judgment, brought the town up a little, quite a bit, with the restaurants, the parking, the list goes on and on. So it's been a great success story. It really helped.
Thank you, Senator. Couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Then with that, we will lay over Senate file.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
557, possible inclusion in the one-time omnibus bill. We have one more bill to hear, but Senator Dibble is apparently testifying on another bill in another committee, correct? And so what we're going to do now is we'll take about a 20-minute recess, and when we come back, we should have – we'll hear Senator Dibble's bill, and we should have a couple of sheets of recommendation as far as spreadsheets are concerned. We're not going to have language, but you'll at least be able to look at some numbers, and I'll have the fiscal staff here explain what we're trying to do and see how far we go. So with this, we'll take a recess for 20 minutes or half an hour.
Okay.